Today's speaker is Frank Loeffler. He is the Governor's Chair Professor at the University of Tennessee and also appointed at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. He has appointments in the Department of Microbiology, the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UT, and also Oak Ridge National Labs Biosciences Division. He is also the Director of the Center for Environmental Biotechnology at UT. You may also have heard him as part of the February 9th, 2015 CLUIN webinar sponsored by the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, and that was titled Biogeochemical Factors Impacting In-Situ Remediation of Chlorinated Contaminants. And that is also archived on CLUIN, as well as today's session will be later on. I last heard him speak at the NIEHS Fest in this past December, and I want to make sure that our audience was aware of his research. And so with that, before I turn it over to Frank, I remind everybody to please put their phones on mute, and you can hit star six to do so. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay. So Mike, thank you very much for the introduction. I would like to thank you and, of course, the EPA for giving me the opportunity to present. So my slide is there. So I'm going to talk a little bit about detoxification of priority chloro-organic pollutants. And I will mostly focus on groundwater environments, but some of the things that I will be discussing obviously also apply to other environments. The focus on groundwater is justified because if you think about the freshwater resources on the planet Earth, the majority of the water is actually salt water in the oceans, and only a minute fraction is fresh water, about 2.5%. And of that fresh water, only 20% are groundwater. And this is actually the major resource for drinking water for the majority of the population. The other water, fresh water, 80%, or close to 80%, is contained in ice caps and glaciers. And the water we see in rivers and lakes, it's actually a minute fraction of that. It's only 1%. So that gives you an idea why groundwater is such a valuable resource for drinking water. And we have to be concerned that water's quality is maintained so it's suitable for human consumption. On the next slide, I give you an idea about contaminated sites in the United States. So all these dots represent a contaminated site, 1,300 Superfund sites, and then a larger number of so-called RCRA, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act sites, also contaminated sites, and then probably more than 450,000 brownfield sites. What that translates to is the following. 166 million people in the U.S. live within 3 miles of a Superfund or an RCRA corrective action site, and that equals to 53% of the U.S. population, including 50% of all children under the age of 5, are living within one of these contaminated areas. And that obviously is a concern because exposure to these chemicals has been linked to human health effects. Now, the situation is not much different in Europe. Also, in Europe, you know, we have a large number of contaminated sites, so only a fraction of those have been remediated, and there's a large number of potentially contaminated sites that have not been really, the issues have not been addressed. So the threat to groundwater is obvious. Now, in the U.S. and Europe, the majority of these contaminated sites are impacted with chlorinated compounds, particularly chlorinated solvents. In the rest of my talk, I will be focusing on these chlorinated solvents, but the aspects I'm discussing obviously also are relevant for the remediation of other chlorinated compounds, such as polychlorinated biphenyls and other chloro-organic contaminants that are not chlorinated solvents. So in the next slide, you see tetrachloroethene on the right side, on the left side, and this is a very commonly used chlorinated solvent for dry cleaning operations. If you remove one chlorine substituent, replace it with a hydrogen, you come to TCE, and TCE is commonly used as an industrial solvent. So these two compounds have been heavily used as chlorinated solvents for a variety of applications. So now you can continue the stepwise removal of chlorine substituents, replacing it with a hydrogen, and ultimately you come to a non-toxic compound, ethene. And each reductive dechlorination step requires an electron donor. So reductive dechlorination is an electron-consuming process, meaning you need an electron donor for this process to proceed. And so now some microbes, some specialized bacteria, have developed a strategy to capture the energy associated with reductive dechlorination, and they can grow at the expense of reductive dechlorination. We call those organisms organohalide respiring bacteria. The process organohalide respiration, or you can also call it respiratory reductive dechlorination. So these organisms look at these chlorinated compounds as a source of energy, and they utilize these compounds to gain energy and support their growth. So they benefit from the contaminants. And so I don't want to advertise this too much, but if you are interested in some background information about these types of organisms and how these organisms can be exploited for remediation, this book came out last year, and many experts in this field have contributed chapters, and that gives you a good overview of this field of organohalide respiration and the application of these organisms for solving real-world problems. So now, if you look at this pathway going from PCE to non-toxic ethene, so ethene is the non-toxic end product that everybody would like to see. And these other compounds are toxic. And now you notice that a couple compounds, vinyl chloride, VC, and TCE, trichloroethene, have two crossbones. And that's for a reason, because those compounds are proven human carcinogens. And over the recent years, TCE, trichloroethene, has also been implicated in the development of Parkinson's disease, and also premature birth. So for those reasons, it's obvious that we don't want to be exposed to these chemicals in groundwater consumption. So if you think about a spill of chlorinated solvents by a factory, by a dry cleaning facility that had to dispose the spent dry cleaning fluid, these solvents are volatile. And a large fraction will volatilize and go to the atmosphere where these chemicals are destroyed. But some of this material will also penetrate the subsurface. And these chlorinated solvents are heavier than water. Okay? So they sink to the water table. And when they hit the water table, because of their high density, they continue with a downward migration until they hit a confining layer where they pool. And these pools are so-called dense non-aqueous phase liquids, DNAPLs. And those can serve as a long-term source of PCE-TCE feeding a groundwater plume that moves with the groundwater flow. So in red, you see this dissolved phase contaminant plume, and the issue arises when people, for example, have drinking water wells and are exposed to these toxic chemicals. So that's an issue we would like to address using bioremediation. And so we were looking for many years, and so were many other groups, for organisms, bacteria, that can degrade these toxic chemicals. And so a number of organisms has been described that can dechlorinate PCE to TCE and even further to cis-dichloroethene. But there was some ambiguity what happens to these partially dechlorinated compounds. And it took some time, and you know, people were looking very hard. Are there organisms that can further dechlorinate dichloroethene and vinyl chloride to non-toxic ethene? And so what people found was a unique group of bacteria we now call Dihalococcoides McCartii. And it appears that this dechlorination of cis-dichloroethene and vinyl chloride to non-toxic ethene was restricted to this organismal group. And so based on this observation, people have now monitored for more than a decade contaminated sites for the presence of this type of microbe, and then they could show at many sites that when this type of microorganism was present, they could detect ethene formation. So this organism has been linked to this process of detoxification of chlorinated ethenes to non-toxic ethene. I just want to report a few new findings from our laboratory that may expand our understanding of this organismal group involved in detoxification. So we took some samples from a pristine source. What you see here on the left is grape pomace compost. So basically the residues of grapes in the winemaking process. We took samples from this material, established microcosms, and we're asking the questions, can these organisms in this sample material dechlorinate TC to ethene? And we did see this activity, and then could actually enrich for an organism that could dechlorinate vinyl chloride to ethene. So that's shown on the right-hand graphic. We feed the culture vinyl chloride, the vinyl chloride goes away, we see ethene formation, and then we spike in more vinyl chloride, and we see again vinyl chloride disappears and ethene is formed. So apparently, this pristine environment, not related to an aquifer, contains organisms that can dechlorinate vinyl chloride. We did then more investigative studies. So for example, we looked at who is present in this enrichment culture by doing 16S rRNA gene amplicon sequencing. And I just want to point out two organismal groups that one we did find, the other one we did not see. You will notice that Dihalococcoides in red, in the bottom, was not present in this culture. But we did find a substantial contribution of Dihalogenimonas organisms that we then postulated are involved in vinyl chloride reductive dechlorination. So we could get the genome of this Dihalogenimonas in this culture by mapping it to existing Dihalogenimonas genomes, okay? And we have a nearly complete genome that we could then analyze for the presence of reductive dehalogenase genes involved in this reductive dechlorination process we are interested in. And so we could also obviously obtain the 16S rRNA gene of this organism. And so what I want to point out here, you see the Dihalococcoides McCartii group, you know, that has been the focus of being the key organisms for detoxification at chlorinated ethene contaminated sites. And then we have this group Dihalogenimonas. And in red is the organism that we found in our enrichment culture, which we call Dihalogenimonas etheniformans. That now is an organism that can apparently also contribute to chlorinated ethene dechlorination to non-toxic ethene. And we could demonstrate that this organism can actually grow with TC, cis-TC, and vinyl chloride, just as we have found for many of these Dihalococcoides McCartii organisms. So the key point here is that members of this genus Dihalogenimonas can also contribute to detoxification of chlorinated ethenes to non-toxic ethene. So we ought to expand our screening efforts to include Dihalogenimonas and not just focus on dehalococcoidis McCartii. So we looked more carefully into the genome of this new organism that we have obtained, and we found a large number of reductive dehalogenase genes on its genome. So all the red ones are new reductive dehalogenase genes contributed by this organism. And we found, we did a proteomics analysis where we grew the organism on TCE, cis-DCE, 1,1-DCE, or vinyl chloride, and we actually then observed the key reductive dehalogenases that were expressed under these different growth conditions. And I think what we can suggest from this analysis, if you look at the blue ring, the blue, this is the most abundant protein expressed in cultures grown with vinyl chloride. And this reductive dehalogenase is phylogenetically related to the known chlorinated ethene reductive dehalogenases. So this is in this blue box. So we propose that this particular reductive dehalogenase is a new vinyl chloride reductive dehalogenase. And so looking for this gene would provide an additional biomarker for monitoring contaminated sites for the ability to detoxify vinyl chloride. So then we worked with Microbial Insights, a company that provides molecular biological tools to screen environmental samples for the presence of organisms of interest. And we had access to their database, or I should say part of their database, where they analyzed 1,173 groundwater samples from 111 sites for the presence of Dehalococcoides and Dehalogenemonas. And again, the focus has been on Dehalococcoides, but Microbial Insights for some time now also monitors for Dehalogenemonas. And we were a little surprised that we found in the majority of samples, 849, we found both organisms present, Dehalococcoides and Dehalogenemonas. So these are all chlorinated solvent sites. And in 65% of these samples, we noticed that Dehalogenemonas, in fact, outnumbered Dehalococcoides in abundance. So these findings suggest that Dehalogenemonas is also an important genus contributing to detoxification of chlorinated ethenes at chlorinated ethene-contaminated sites. So now, with this knowledge, obviously we would like to improve contaminated site restoration, particularly aquifers. So what's commonly done is you have a plume that originates from a source zone with DNAPL. You obviously would like to cut off the plume from the DNAPL source zone by treating the source zone with appropriate technologies that can also include bioremediation. But then to treat the plume, you typically install a bioreactive barrier that intersects the plume perpendicular. And so the idea is that in this zone, you have an active microbial community that dechlorinates the contaminants to non-toxic products. Remember what I said in the beginning, reductive dechlorination is an electron-consuming process. And at many sites, the organisms, Dehalococcoides, Dehalogenemonas, are limited by the availability of electron donor. The electron donor these organisms require is hydrogen, or possibly formate for some of the Dehalogenemonas organisms, but let's just stick with hydrogen. So what you can do, you can add electron donor. This process is called biostimulation, and you then provide electron donor to these organisms with the idea that they become more active and have enough reducing equivalent to perform reductive dechlorination. The goal would be that in this bioreactive zone, you have enough activity that no contaminant mass is leaving the zone. Basically, you clean up the plume. At some sites where the abundance of these key organisms is low, you can do bioaugmentation. So So you can add cultures that contain the Helicocoides or possibly the Halogenomonas, and you can increase the number of these organisms, but generally relates to higher dechlorination rates observed in the field. And these are two examples of commercially available consortia to achieve to do bioaugmentation and achieve higher dechlorination rates. So now here's a simplified model how this process works. So here's a Dehelicocoides cell, Dehelicocoides mccartii strain BAF1, capable of detoxifying dichloroethenes and vinyl chloride to ethene. The organism requires hydrogen as electron donor. Hydrogen is oxidized, and the electrons are transferred to a reductive dehalogenase protein in green that then catalyzes reductive dechlorination and ultimately ethene formation and detoxification. This process is coupled with proton transport across the membrane, and the influx of these protons across the membrane is coupled with ATP synthesis. So the organism gains energy and can grow at the expense of this process. So that's a very important observation. The organisms benefit from this contaminant and the increase in abundance, and that typically translates to higher rates. So one thing I want to focus on now is the following. This reductive dehalogenase, the key enzyme catalyzing reductive dechlorination, requires a carotenoid cofactor. Now, what is this? In simple words, the organism requires vitamin B12, specifically for this reductive dehalogenase to perform reductive dechlorination. So now what's a little perplexing is that the organism, the Dehelicocoides or Dehalogenomonas, at least most of them, cannot synthesize carotenoid. They cannot make their own vitamin B12. And this is shown in this slide. So this is the Dehelicocoides strain BAF1 that can detoxify dichloroethenes to ethene. If you have cultures with no vitamin B12, they don't dechlorinate. That's a top figure. Cis DCE is not dechlorinated. You get a cis DCE stall. If you have a limited amount of carotenoid that's in the middle, you see some dechlorination, but this dichloroethene is not completely detoxified to ethene. And you see vinyl chloride comes up and is not further dechlorinated. So these are situations where you would then see a vinyl chloride stall. If you have sufficient vitamin B12 in the culture, the organism dechlorinates cis DCE and vinyl chloride to non-toxic ethene. So you get complete dechlorination or detoxification. So apparently, the amount of vitamin B12 or carotenoid is essential to stimulate reductive dechlorination. So this is a carotenoid, vitamin B12 type compound. Don't worry too much about the structure. I just want to point out a few features. So there's an upper ligand that can vary, and there's a lower base in red, and this can vary quite a bit. If it's dimethylbenzimidazole, shown in red, DMB, and the upper group is the cyano group, it's vitamin B12. But the biology has many more options for this lower base and can substitute this DMB with a variety of other lower bases. And so different organisms produce different carotenoids with different lower bases. And Dehelicocoides can't do that. So it requires to take up these compounds from the microbial community and use them for reductive dechlorination. So the question we ask is, who supplies this carotenoid to Dehelicocoides that Dehelicocoides requires but can't make on its own? So an organism that can dechlorinate PC to cis DCE is Geobacter lovelii. This one can produce carotenoid. And so we ask the simple question, can this carotenoid producer supply the carotenoid, the vitamin B12 derivative, to dihelocorcoides so that dihelocorcoides can become active. We did these experiments. So we have on the left side a carotenoid producing organism. On the right side, dihelocorcoides McCartii, or dihalogenimonas, that requires carotenoid in order to grow and do reductive dechlorination. We put them together in co-culture and then just observed, is dechlorination occurring or not? And as predicted, in a co-culture between dihelocorcoides, strain BAF1 or strain FL2, and Geobacter lovelii, we did see dihelocorcoides growth indicative of reductive dechlorination, because they can only grow via reductive dechlorination. But then we tested several other carotenoid-producing cultures, including another Geobacter species, acetogens, and also methanogens, all organisms known to produce carotenoid. And we could determine that they actually did produce carotenoid. But none of them supported dihelocorcoides growth. That was very perplexing to us. We couldn't figure it out initially. But then we had the idea of adding dimethylbenzimidazole to these inactive cultures and could demonstrate that now they all started dechlorinating. Apparently now dihelocorcoides became active after adding DMB. So recall, DMB is this lower base in this lower position here. And apparently, these other organisms produced carotenoid, but put a different lower base in this position. And then the dihelocorcoides couldn't use it. And I go a little further here. These are experiments that we published last year. So this is the dihelocorcoides strain BAF1. That can dechlorinate cis dichloroethene to ethene. And if we have a carotenoid in this culture that carries DMB, so this is the structure shown on the right, so the upper part of this figure. So this is a carotenoid dihelocorcoides can use, and you see relatively high dechlorination rates and ethene formation. You take the same culture under the same growth conditions, but supply the culture with a different carotenoid, one that carries benzimidazole, the lower figure on the right. That's benzimidazole, and this is the lower base for the carotenoid. So the only difference is that these two methyl groups are lacking. And this has a profound impact on the organism. Reductive dechlorination rates were much slower. Okay? So the point here is the type of lower base, the type of carotenoid the community provides to dihelocorcoides affects the rates of reductive dechlorination catalyzed by dihelocorcoides. So I take it a step further in the next slide. So this is another organism that that harbors a vinyl chloride reductive dehalogenase that can also dechlorinate cis-DCE. We did the same experiment, and you see with dimethyl benzimidazole in the upper figure, we see ethene formation and relatively high dechlorination rates. If we replace the lower base in the carotenoid provided to this culture, the organism with this VCRA reductive dehalogenase basically produces vinyl chloride as end product. So the point here is that not only are the rates affected by the type of lower base incorporated in the carotenoid, it also affects dechlorination extent. And that could potentially explain why you see vinyl chloride stalls at contaminated sites. So now on the next slide, I summarize what I just talked about. The key points are that carotenoid quantity matter to dihelocorcoides. They need enough carotenoid in order to perform reductive dechlorination and produce ethene. So that's shown in the left side of the slide. And then they also care about the quality of the coronoid. So specific lower bases support reductive declination, and other lower bases generate a coronoid the helicocoides cannot use. So for obvious reasons, you know, we would like to understand under what conditions does the microbial community generate coronoids with the appropriate lower base to allow reductive declination performance by the Dehalococcoides or the Dehalogenimonas. So in order to answer this question, we took samples from two different contaminated sites, a river sediment in Knoxville, Tennessee, the Third Creek site, and a Superfund site in Vermont. Both were contaminated with chlorinated ethenes and other co-contaminants. We took samples from these locations, the sediment samples, and then groundwater and core material from this contaminated aquifer in Vermont. And we established microcosms in the laboratory, and then transferred the chlorinating microcosms repeatedly so that we got enrichment cultures. To these different microcosms, we did not add any vitamin B12. So all the vitamin B12, or the coronoids produced, were produced by the microbes in these cultures. And we performed enrichments under different conditions. So we had fermenting conditions, nitrate-reducing conditions, ion-reducing conditions, sulfate-reducing conditions, methanogenic conditions. Under all these conditions, chlorinated ethenes were dechlorinated. And we did monitor what types of coronoids are produced under these different geochemical conditions. And so now the first observation was that under these different geochemical conditions, different amounts of coronoid were produced, okay? So the higher the bar, the more coronoid was produced, and lower bars, like ion-reducing conditions, you saw relatively small amounts of coronoid produced. So remember I told you before that the amount of coronoid is important. Now, we also looked at the types of coronoids that were produced. And that's the next slide. So the colors indicate different types of coronoids. And when I say different types, it means different lower bases. In green, it's dimethylbenzimidazole. This is the type of coronoid the helicocoides prefers. Okay, so this is the type of coronoid that you would expect the helicocoides to have good activity, and you see ethene formation. But then you, for example, see that under methanogenic conditions, this type of coronoid is not produced. The next slide, I kind of summarize the same findings again. So whenever you see a plus, the type of coronoid, the type of lower base in the left column is produced by the microbial community. Now I point out one thing here. Oh, on the left side, the green in green indicates that those are lower bases where you see the helicocoides activity. In red, you don't see the helicocoides activity. And the two in the middle that have both symbols indicate that you see some activity, but it's not, the rates are low, and the extent may not result in productive ethene formation. And now you can see that under what conditions dimethylbenzimidazole type coronoid is produced in green, so under fermenting, ion-reducing, sulfate-reducing, nitrate-reducing, but not under methanogenic conditions. Under methanogenic conditions, you know, you produce a lot of coronoid, the bottom three, that are not being used by the helicocoides. So what this, the interpretation would be, that if you generate methanogenic conditions at a site, methanogens produce carinoids that are not necessarily supportive of reductive declination mediated by Dehalococcoides or Dehalogenemonas. So from a practical point of view, if you think about this, you have a contaminated plume and you do biostimulation. And then if reductive declination activity is not sufficient to meet the site-specific requirements, so in this case, TCE is not going away at the rate and the extent you would like to see, a common response is to add more electron donor. If you add more electron donor, what typically happens is that you see excessive methane formation because the majority of the reducing equivalents are now being consumed by methanogens. Now, if you follow what I said before, you have a lot of methanogens, they produce a lot of carinoid that are the wrong type to support the Dehalococcoides reductive declination activity. So you may not help the situation by adding too much electron donor because you manipulate the microbial community in a way that is not favorable for reductive declination and ethene formation. So I hope I made that clear. So it's not just to meet the requirements for electron donor, which I actually have misspelled on this slide, my apologies. So it's not just the requirement for more electron donor to meet the requirement of these reductively declinating populations for reducing equivalents to perform reductive declination. It's also other requirements that have to be met. One important requirement is the availability of the appropriate carinoid generated, produced by the microbial community, and then transferred to the Dehalococcoides. And this carinoid must support reductive declination by the reductive dehalogenases the Dehalococcoides produces. And this can be more complicated when you have methanogens producing the wrong type of carinoid. And this would then actually explain, you know, why you would see cis-DCE or vinyl chloride stalls, because the wrong type of carinoid, you know, in the extent is impacted, the rates are impacted, and then you have faster dechlorination of the higher chlorinated compounds, but vinyl chloride, a lower chlorinated ethene, does not go away at the appropriate rates, and you see a vinyl chloride formation, or typically is interpreted as a vinyl chloride stall. Okay, with that I want to end and leave some room for questions. I have to thank my laboratory, you know, a number of people work on this, on aspects of reductive declination. And I have several collaborators at other institutions that help us analyzing data from contaminated sites, interpreting the data, and then hopefully develop new understanding about these microbes or these microbial communities that can ultimately help us to more efficiently degrade toxic contaminants and ensure that groundwater quality is safe and groundwater is appropriate for human consumption. So a lot of this work supported by the Department of Defense through CERDAP and ESTCP, and that green box, that's another important funding agency for this work, that's NIEHF, the National Institute for Environmental Health Systems, that specifically provide some support to look into these geochemical aspects of carinoid bioavailability to Dehalococcoides. And with that, I would hope that there are some questions, and I will do my best to give a good answer. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank. We do have a couple of questions here, and I'm going to I had one because I think I had asked you one a couple months ago, but this gives time for folks, if you do have a question, to go ahead and type it in, and we'll get to it in a minute. One of the questions I would think right away for some people was, and maybe you addressed it, I don't know if I missed it, the issue about why wouldn't you sort of augment your solution that you would inject with vitamin B12? Do you think that is a possibility, or is still more research on that needed?
Theoretically, an obvious idea. Why not do that? And actually, some vendors have immediately responded when it became clear that carotenoid may be an issue. So why not add vitamin B12, which carries dimethylbenzimidazole as lower base? What we know is a good one for dehalococcoides to perform reductive dechlorination. So we did experiments in the laboratory where we added vitamin B12, you know, in different concentrations to microcosms or enrichment cultures. And in all instances, the vitamin B12 that was added is very quickly consumed by the microbial community. Maybe degraded, but at least taken up by microbes. It's a valuable resource, okay? They take it up very quickly. In all cases, that happened so fast that before the dehalococcoides could even see the day of light, before they could dechlorinate anything, the vitamin B12 addition had been completely consumed by other microbes. So we have not done this in the field, but my prediction would be if you add expensive vitamin B12 to a contaminated site, it will be very quickly consumed by the microbial community, and dehalococcoides doesn't see it.
Okay.
So theoretically, an approach that could be attempted, but I would caution, I do not believe it will solve the problem and make the right carotenoid bioavailable to dehalococcoides. My assessment is, my suggestion is, let's understand the microbes, the microbial community, so that we can better stimulate those microbes and ensure that they produce the correct carotenoid for dehalococcoides, rather than adding something and the effects are unclear. Let me spin this a little further. You know, you could also think about just adding DMB, dimethylbenzimidazole, the lower base, to a contaminated site. This may be cheaper. And the dehalococcoides has the ability to exchange lower bases. So if methanogens produce the wrong carotenoid, but you add DMB, the dehalococcoides can take the wrong carotenoid, exchange the lower base, and produce a carotenoid it likes. So that's something we demonstrate in the laboratory. Now, we have never attempted that in the field.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how quickly DMB is consumed by other microbes. But theoretically, this may be a more feasible approach, cheaper approach, to ensure that dehalococcoides has the right carotenoid available.
Okay, so we do have a couple questions. One of them is regarding slide 26. So I was going. All right. And the question is, how did you establish the different redox conditions for that experiment?
Okay, so for fermenting conditions, we added lactate. And we also had a series where we added glucose. For nitrate-reducing conditions, we added nitrate as an electron acceptor. And we monitored the microcosms and the enrichment cultures basically daily to ensure that the electron acceptor never ran out. So basically during these enrichments, nitrate was always present. For ion reduction, we added solid ferric oxyhydroxide. For sulfate, it's the same with nitrate. We monitored sulfate reduction, and as soon as sulfate was consumed, we added additional sulfate so that this redox condition prevailed during the enrichment process. For methanogenic, we added lactate or glucose, so initially fermenting, but then methanogens took over, and we monitored your methane production. For the fermenting enrichment, I should say, we added an inhibitor for methanogenesis, 2-bromoethane sulfonate. So that ensured that methanogens were not growing in these fermenting enrichments, so that we could really attribute the coenoids produced in this these cultures are from fermenting organisms and not from methanogens. That's what we did.
Okay, thank you. I had another question regarding the applicability of this to other compounds. And the question is, this research seems to focus on remediation of chlorinated versions of ethene. What part of this research, if any of it, can be extended to the remediation of 1,2-dichloroethane?
So 1,2-dichloroethane can also be degraded under anoxic conditions. And so there are different organisms involved. I think the Helicocoides could be one of them. Also the Halogenomonas is involved in 1,2-dichloroethane reductive dechlorination. And so then the same rationale that I laid out here would also apply. To date, all reductive dehalogenases people have looked at, okay, all the new findings indicate that these reductive dehalogenase enzyme systems require coenoid for function. So what I said with chlorinated ethenes very likely applies to all all reductive dehalogenases, and therefore would also apply to reductive dechlorination of chlorinated ethanes, reductive dechlorination of chloroform, reductive dechlorination of chlorinated benzenes, reductive dechlorination of polychlorinated biphenyls. Okay, so this theme that I described most likely applies to reductive dechlorination of many other compounds mediated by organisms like these organohalide respiring chloroflexi that can do these reactions but cannot produce their own coronoid and depend on the community to supply this essential cofactor for the reductive dehalogenases.
Okay, thanks. Another question here regarding a field perspective. I know that some of these things haven't been tried at that field level, and maybe you don't have a diagnostic on this, but the question is, what level of dissolved methane in groundwater would be considered excessive? Or do you have a feel for how, is there a measurement for that?
Okay, so so I can't answer the question of how much methane dissolved in groundwater. You know, I don't know the answer to this. The point was that when you have excessive methane formation, so methanogens are making methane, then the methanogens are growing because in their metabolism, right, when they are growing, they produce methane. So if you have more methane being produced, that means that the methanogens are growing. And that means that they produce coronoids the Helicocoides doesn't like. And, you know, then it depends what does the rest of the microbial community do. If the methanogens take over a system and the majority of the electron donor that you are adding ends up in methane, most likely the majority of the population in this aquifer are methanogens producing the wrong type of coronoid. it's not a good situation because of the reasons I described. But there are other reasons. You know, methane is a greenhouse gas. We don't, you know, the expensive electron donor is being converted to methane. So you lose money because the electron donor is going to something, a useless product. And as a matter of fact, the greenhouse gas. So we talk about the footprint, the carbon footprint of remediation. I just caution for adding too much electron donor unless you are really convinced that the electron donor is the limitation for reductive dechlorination. If this is not clearly established, adding more donor could generate other issues that will not solve the problem of effectively removing the contaminants. So you can measure methane concentration over time. If they go up, then you know that methanogens are being, you know, are active and consuming the donor you're adding. You can also envision to include molecular biological tools to monitor the methanogen community. Those tools are available. So you can monitor how many methanogens are present over time. And if they show a strong response to your treatment, you know, then you know that the methanogens are being stimulated. And then you have to think about maybe a different type of electron donor, maybe less electron donor, or modify your strategy that you don't run into these issues that I described.
We did have a question about regarding the environment that the microorganisms need to grow, you know, temperature range, pH, or oxygen. But most of the organisms that you're talking about, you extracted from field sites, correct?
Well, so many of the dehelicocoides isolates and enrichment cultures that are available were derived from contaminated sites. A few isolates are from pristine environments. And the halogenemonas that I described was not from an aquifer at all. It was from a compost. But there's plenty of evidence that these types of dehalogenemonas are abundant in aquifers. Okay, so we probably would have collected the right sample, we would have found a similar organism in an aquifer material. So the other question was oxygen, pH, and temperature?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So these organohalite respiring chloroflexi, so the key organisms involved in this reductive dechlorination process, they don't like oxygen. So if the groundwater has a lot of dissolved oxygen, is oxic, don't expect to see too much activity. But don't be fooled by dissolved oxygen measurements or information from redox-sensitive electrodes, because they are notoriously wrong. You know, measuring dissolved oxygen is complicated. And so better indicators for anoxic conditions would be look for methane. If you have methane, it's anoxic. Look for ferrous ion. If you have ferrous ion, it's a good indicator that the groundwater is anoxic. And if you measure, you know, low dissolved oxygen, probably there are still plenty of anoxic pockets where you can have reductive dechlorination activity occurring. So evaluate this very carefully. Don't put too much emphasis on dissolved oxygen concentrations, because many of these data are not so reliable. In terms of pH, so most of these organisms prefer neutral, circumneutral pH values. If the pH drops below 6, the helicocoides slows down. If the pH goes below 5.5, the helicocoides that have been grown at neutral pH may still do a little bit, but they don't grow anymore. So reductive dechlorination by the helicocoides, and probably also the halogenemonas, at pH 5.5 and lower is not sustainable. Okay, so this will probably not be a productive remedy. And then you have to think about alternative approaches. Maybe you can adjust the pH. There may be other things you can do. Now, we did find that organisms that can decline at PCE to cis-DCE, especially those belonging to the genus Sulfurospirillum, okay, those grow and declinate at pH 5.5. Those were actually the only ones we found. But this may be important if you consider remediation of DNAPL source zones relying on microbiology. You may have heard about this concept of microbially enhanced DNAPL dissolution. So the principle here is that organisms that can reductively declinate PCE or TCE close to the DNAPL, they can increase the dissolution rate of TCE, PCE in three-phase form into the aqueous phase. And so obviously you have a lot of declination, so the pH will go down, and organisms like Sulfurospirillum may be very important to achieve enhanced DNAPL dissolution. And then you basically generate a cis-DCE plume, but downstream, where the pH is closer to neutral, the Helicococcus, the Halogenomonas can do their job, and ultimately you end up with ethene. Regarding temperature, in the laboratory, you know, we can obviously manipulate the temperature incubation temperature easily. So we can see good activity anywhere between 20 and 30, 35 degrees Celsius. Obviously, many aquifer groundwater temperature is lower. That will slow down the rate somewhat, but there's plenty of evidence that even aquifers at 10 degrees, Dehalococcoides and presumably Dehalogenomonas can be active and do their job. Obviously at lower rates, but this will still work. There's even evidence for dechlorination in really cold aquifers in Alaska, where the aquifer groundwater temperature is close to 4 degrees. But the rates will obviously slow down.
Okay, great. I didn't see a whole lot of different questions that came in. If we didn't get to your question, we will try to respond to it by email. And what we would like you to do now is, as we wrap up here, is hit the seminar feedback link in the center right of your screen and fill out our feedback form. During that feedback form, there's going to be a checkbox that allows you, maybe a checkbox next to you, the request for your email to get an email that says you participated in today's event. And you should also listen for or stay tuned for the archive of this, which will happen in a couple of weeks and be available on fluin.org. And we'd like to thank today's presenter, Frank Loeffler from the University of Tennessee and Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Thank you very much, and we hope that everybody enjoys your afternoon. Thank you.